meeting of the Environmental Quality Board together. I believe we do have a quorum. Commissioner Cronk is not going to be in attendance today.
Hello.
Kate Knuth is going to be just a little bit late, and Ms. Edmond will not be joining us today either. So we are assembled, and I think we'll just dispense with introductions. Looking at the crowd, we know you, and you know us. So why don't we then get right to the business at hand, which is the motion to adopt the consent agenda. You've had an opportunity, hopefully, to preview the agenda. And if there are no additions or corrections to the agenda, a motion would be in order that would include the minutes of the March 20th meeting.
So also. Moved.
There second. Is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Let's go straight to the chair's report, which is really thin this time. I'm continued to be frustrated with the weather. How about you? And after that, there is one
motion
point.
On
yeah, right. There is one addition that I would like to comment on, and that is the letter that is dated April 16th. It should be in front of you, and it is a response to Mr. Falcom and Ms. Burke and Ms. Brown regarding their concern and over the Superior Sand Transfer Facility. I, Bob and I collaborated, and we responded in this fashion, so that has been addressed. Hopefully we have concurrence on the content of the letter. Beyond that, I will ask Bob to give a executive director's report, please, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time, hopefully not a lot here, giving you a little budget and legislative update. As you know, bills are moving through the legislature, having to do with the budget and also having to do with silica sand. And so I just wanted to give you an update on those things and also kind of put this in the context of the upcoming workshop and things that are ahead of us. So first of all, in terms of the bills that are moving forward, there's language and budget numbers in the bills, of course. They're both in omnibus bills in the House and Senate side. So the House omnibus is House File 976, and the Senate file is Senate File 1607. There are differences between the bills, pretty significant ones. On the House side, so far, the governor's recommendations for funding the operating budget of the EQB are intact at $500,000 a year. There are the silica sand provisions in the bill, mandates to the EQB that were identical for a while in the House and Senate. And what these constitute are their mandates to the EQB, or it's jobs given to the EQB to develop model standards and criteria to assemble an interagency technical assistance team to assist local RGUs and local governments, and to put together a technical assistance online library of ordinances and permits, mostly. And those all have a due date of a pretty ambitious due date of October 1st of this year. There are appropriations that go along with that actually exceed what the governor's recommendations were. So they're pretty significant. I can give you the numbers if you wish. The appropriations would be there are transfers of those appropriations from what goes into the PCA budget, which is, of course, where we're housed, to MDH, DNR, Bowser, and MnDOT to support that interagency activity. Now, on the Senate side, there are the Senate did not recommend the additional funds to the EQB, so that's recommending the existing budget of $151,000 a year on the Senate side right now. And Finance Committee is today, and I haven't heard what news that's going on right now or finishing up right now. I haven't heard news from that. The silica sand provisions are that I mentioned before are still in there. However, instead of having EQB given those jobs, they are given to DNR, MDH, and MnDOT to work cooperatively with local governments. There is also a good cause rulemaking mandate to the EQB to make amendments to the environmental review rules to clarify matters having to do with silica sand mining. And that has a very ambitious deadline as well of August of this year. There are also by the way, some mandated rulemakings regarding silica sand for PCA, DNR, and MDH in the bill. There's no appropriation that I could find for those model standards or those silica sand provisions. And then there is an appropriation of $300,000 for that EQB rulemaking that I mentioned. So that's any questions about that before I move on.
Questions?
I just wanted to mention, you know, given all that, and we are looking forward, and we'll have Ellen Anderson will be going over the upcoming workshop. If the governor's recommendations do get adopted in terms of our operating budget, then that would. I believe that was based on five FTEs, so that would be an executive director and four staff, including the two existing staff. If that goes forward, that's what that would look like. If not, we obviously we're a little bit back to the drawing board in terms of figuring out what to do with meeting the responsibilities that the board already has. And regarding those responsibilities, we're going to be talking about some of those things today. As we go into the work planning, we need to remember that we have a number of things that are already on our plate, including the Minnesota River study that Kate is going to be talking about next. The silica sand EIS will be on our plate. That will pretty much be a cost reimbursement situation, but still has some time aspects to existing staff. And there are the environmental review duties that are the routine work that we do, the administration and the rulemaking, the improvements that we've already said we wanted to do through the executive order recommendations. And there are really a number of guidance improvements that we really need to make that will take staff time. In addition to those, any other continuing efforts out of the executive order, report card work, or future Congresses. So that's just a little list of things that are kind of on our plate right now and we need to think about as we go into the future, considering the resources that are available to the EQB. And with that, will stop.
Questions? None.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Minnesota River Basin Integrated Watershed Study update and discussion. Welcome, Kate.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Kate France, and I've been working on this project with the Army Corps of Engineers as a representative of the EQB. Some of you are probably more familiar with this project than others, so I hope to speak with you today about this project to make sure that everybody is up to date on what's currently going on with this, as considering the EQB is a co-sponsor of this project. So to begin with, this project was initiated in 2008 after a 2005 Minnesota River Watershed Reconnaissance Study, which recommended an integrated watershed study, this study. For this study, the Army Corps of Engineers is the federal sponsor, and the EQB acts as the non-federal study sponsor. So the objectives of the study are twofold. First is to develop a plan for the watershed, including the aquatic ecosystem, and develop and encourage water quality management and restoration in the Minnesota River Basin. Secondly, is to develop a decision support system, which is referred to as a DSS, which is planned to be an interactive tool consisting of a family of process-based simulation models, geographical information systems, commonly called GIS, topographic data, ecological economics valuation models, agricultural economics valuation models, plan formulation, alternatives analysis, and evaluation models. Basically, what all that means is that really the overarching goal here of the project is to develop a basin-wide management plan and decision support tool through a collaborative, transparent process which identifies actions that may be taken to improve hydrologic conditions, water quality of the basin, and ecological structure and function while balancing the social and economic activities of the basin. So as you can see from this slide, the Army Corps of Engineers and the EQB act as co-sponsors and coordinators of the project. The full interagency team, which if I can just, so this, all of these groups up here, so not the dotted lines, but all of the other ones, the full interagency team has contributed to the study so far, have included many state agencies, including many of the agencies that sit on the EQB, as well as colleges and universities, federal agencies, local soil and water conservation districts, and tribes. As we move forward, non-governmental organizations, citizens, and other local government units may have a role to play as well in the study. So what does being a non-federal sponsor mean in this case? Well, EQB acts as a hub and coordinator of all of the non-federal, that would mean all of the state agency and all of the academic, the U of M, the Mankato State, those partners, all of that activity. We coordinate and serve as the hub for that. And also we are responsible for managing the cost share. So that can be cash or it can be as in-kind. It's primarily so far been as in-kind. And why is the study important? Well, first and foremost, providing assistance to the resource managers and the public on the ground is a major goal of this project, and to help them to make sound water-related investments and decisions in the basin. Secondly, though, the Minnesota River is part of a greater whole, as we all know. The Minnesota River receives flow from four different states and is a tributary to the Mississippi River. So issues that come up in the Minnesota Basin obviously impact the whole river system, whether that's sediment loading, water flows, nutrient availability, the ecosystem, etc. Finally, the lessons learned here may contribute to developing a comprehensive watershed management plan for not only the upper Mississippi River, but the whole Mississippi River as well. So there are broad systems contributions that this project can make as well. So where are we now? Like I said, we started the project was started with EQB in 2008, and the interagency study team, which I'll remind you was that big group, not just the Corps and the EQB, but that big group of all the agencies, has met 12 times since December of 2008. And the initial phase of the project focused on basically a where are we now? So coordinating individual agency efforts, identifying important planning questions to be addressed by the study, compiling existing data, considering there are many, many different agencies working within this basin, identifying the tools that would be used, the modeling efforts from a hydrologic, hydraulic, water quality, and sediment transport models for this system. Beyond this, since then, the team has developed a conceptual model for how the rest of these variables will interact with the decision support system. The team has ranked the top 25 sub-watersheds for modeling. This is based on available data, and selected the first two sub-basins for modeling to occur at a Tier 3 level. And just to give you a quick breakdown of what the tiers mean, Tier 1 is more geographic. It's what we think of as like a geographic information systems, a GIS, or maybe like a Google Maps sort of thing. That's a Tier 1 level, fairly coarse. And then as you move to Tier 2 and Tier 3, Tier 3 is really based on very detailed, very precise data, involves more field data, and comes out with a more precise set of recommendations for that sub-watershed. So the focus has really been on the Tier 3 smaller scale, which then can be moved up to Tier 2 and Tier 1. So that requires the most data input and is most detailed. Next on the list, we've completed a survey of cross-sections in the Minnesota River main stem, as well as 50 cross-sections on the Seven Mile Creek subwatershed, which, as you've heard previously, has been one of the sub-basins that has been identified for that Tier 3 modeling moving forward. So similarly, where are we now in terms of funding? Back in 2008, this was this was determined to be a 50-50 cost share between the federal and the non-federal sponsor. So the Army Corps is providing 50% as the way the agreement reads, and then the non-federal sponsor, the EQB, is providing 50% as well. At the time in 2008, it was estimated to be approximately an $8.4 million project. And to date, both the EQB and the Army Corps have been working to support this study, and the federal sponsor has contributed, if you add the numbers up, a little less than $1.5 million, and the state sponsor, the non-federal sponsor, is at about $3.3 million, just a little shy of $3.3, which primarily, as you can see, includes in-kind services, as noted here. Just so you know, this is an estimate of funding, and we would need to, if you're looking for more precise numbers, we probably need to look into both recent in-kind numbers as well as any appropriations from the federal level. So in addition to the activities that are already accomplished that we just talked about, there are a number of ongoing activities happening as well. For example, the National Center for Earth Surface Dynamics, NSED, is working on the Greater Blue Earth Basin to do some of the modeling that we're doing in some of these other basins as well. And the Minnesota DNR is working with non-governmental groups on designating the Minnesota River as a national blueway in response to the Blue Ways Initiative created by Ken Salazar and the Department of the Interior. In addition, that Tier 3 modeling, the very detailed modeling, is happening both in the Shakopee Creek, also known as Norway Lake, Basin, and the Seven Mile Creek Basin. These are just a few examples of the many ongoing activities that are happening within the basin and that are connected to this study. So the next steps for the project work plan including completing the models that are already ongoing for Seven Mile and an updated Minnesota hydraulic model. In addition, there will be the development of the website and communications platform, which will provide support not only for the ongoing interagency study team communication, but also to move toward the framework of the decision support system tool that we've talked about. The EQB has provided support up to this point in the form of a web page on the EQB website that acts as a repository for information for this project. However, there are questions about how to move forward from there to a more permanent location for not only this interactive tool, but also to serve as a more nimble and flexible communication platform in the interim so that the researchers can interact more fluidly instead of more just a library of information. So those discussions are ongoing, even though at the time the EQB plans to continue maintaining this website for the project. So the future considerations of the study, as it has been for the duration of the project since 2008, funding and support of the study has been inconsistent, meaning that the rate of progress on the study has been somewhat inconsistent as well. At the federal level, funding of the project could be provided anywhere from the president's budget, it could be included by Congress, or it could be identified by the Corps as a priority and funded from there. The study has received annual support thus far, but it's not a guarantee for support moving forward. Similarly, as we all have known and experienced, the EQB's resources have been in flux during the life of this project, making consistency for this project challenging. In light of these uncertainties, the Corps has been working on rescoping the products and timeline of the study to more adequately match them with the resources that are available. This has its own set of considerations, including the fact that this study was planned using the Integrated Water Resources Management System, that approach, which the Army Corps of Engineers strongly supports, and they have some interest in continuing to support that approach. Similarly, the co-sponsors, meaning the Army Corps and the EQB, have worked out a work plan with milestones and deliverables that would complete the study by December 2017. In addition, there are consequences that need to be considered in rescoping the project. If rescoping means that fewer of those Tier 3 models are done, that could mean that the watershed product will be more general and could really match something that's already been developed. So the question becomes then, where was the additional value if we're not doing those Tier 3 models, those as a basis for the study? Secondly, if you rescope in the process of the public engagement process and reduce the amount of public engagement opportunities you're doing, you could end up with a modeling system that is precise and expertly done, but the watershed product sits on the shelf because you don't have that local buy-in. So that's a challenge for that rescoping. If rescoping means the reduction in work on the social, ecological, and economic models, which are another part of it, separate from what we've done on the hydrology, that could mean that we have a watershed product, which is where the science is clear, but the why should people care, again, the buy-in remains lacking. So there are some choices that clearly still need to be made, and with that, I'm available for questions.
Thanks, Kate, for that thorough explanation.
And that's just the overview. Imagine if you'd gotten the detailed version.
We've only just begun. Yeah. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Started with John.
Thank you.
Mr. Stein.
Kate, your last slide where you talked about rescoping, I'm very interested in. I'm particularly interested because of the limited staff capacity that we have at EQB, and I wanted to just express a desire to engage. Perhaps it would be wise at this time for us to really invest a little bit of our resources as EQB board members to think through that rescoping process with the Corps and understand what work might be feasible to get completed. I'm concerned about all the budgets that we have and just wanted to get a sense of what, when you say the Corps will be rescoping the project, what is that, how does that typically occur? Do you know what their process for doing that is?
Kate?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, Commissioner Stein, the process for that, I have been kind of a sideline observer because it's a process that's occurring within the Corps. Of course, they're being a co-sponsor, it's something that we have feedback with each other on, but it's, like I said, it's something that I've been kind of a sideline observer for. And what I can tell you is that they have a vertical team where the process for the study has been reviewed, and they recently brought that through that vertical team review. But in terms of actually determining, in terms of rescoping, which parts of the project may not be fully supported as was initially thought, a lot of that comes from the internal interagency study team meetings. And so if the team members really feel that that the modeling is good, but what we really need is to get on that public engagement, then that's where the choices would be made. So that has been coming from the interagency study team itself. That being said, decisions are still being discussed. The pros and the cons are being discussed. So your voice in that discussion as the co-sponsor would be welcome.
Follow up?
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. I guess what I just knowing just reading the slides that Kate presented and understanding that the future is uncertain of funding, I think this would be a really good time to sit down with the leadership at the Corps as co-sponsors and have a face-to-face conversation about the likelihood of the scope of the project changing, as well as what we might expect to modify in terms of timelines and work expectations. That said, I'll save my comments about my view of the project overall. I have questions I'd like to explore with the Corps.
Okay, we'll hold that until toward the end of the discussion, and then maybe have a plan of action. John Saxog.
Mr. Chair, Kate, how might this Blue Ways initiative be integrated into the study? Has there been talk about that?
There has been, Mr. Chair, members of the board. There has been discussion about how the Blue Ways initiative dovetails with this project. Now, there are limiting factors. The Blue Ways initiative, the Department of Interior would need to designate the Minnesota River as a official national Blue Ways. So there are some steps that need to be followed through before that could be seen as an opportunity to dovetail. However, and the other thing that is really strikingly different about the two projects is the Blue Ways is more of a grassroots, on the ground. It's a way to encourage public participation, public awareness of their local rivers, and value of their rivers. Whereas this study has largely been very technical, modeling based, and really focused on developing this interactive tool. So while the audience eventually could be similar, we have a real different approach that could have some challenges in combining the two or having them meet somewhere in the middle.
Mr. Chair?
John, please.
Has there been discussion between the DOI and the Corps of Engineers at this point?
I can't speak for the Corps or the DOI. I can only speak to the DNR folks that are working with working on the Blue Ways initiative, and they have been contacting us, and we have been talking about those two efforts. But I don't know what's happening at the federal level.
Thank you.
Other questions? Tom?
Mr. Chair, just a little bit. I think with specifically respect to the Blue Ways, it has been a sort of a new entity launched by Department of Interior, and I don't know that we really have a clear vision of what it is. I mean, typically there's a value for us to participate in a federal initiative like that if there's money that might come from that. Currently, that's not the case, and I guess that's the sort of the promise and the reality of that leads, in my mind, into the promise and the reality of this. I mean, what I'm hearing is that 5 years now, this has been underway. We're talking about 4 years more, 9-year study, which was supposed to be 50-50. It looks like we're 66-33 right now. The state's put the majority of the dollars into that, and we're not halfway done yet. So I guess I got some real concerns, and I'd echo John's sentiment that I think it might be appropriate, given what's happening with the federal budget and the likelihood of adequate funding to come along ultimately, to sit down and reassess where we are, where we proceed. I'm still, in spite of the information we've gotten, I have no idea what this is supposed to do. and I understand there's a lot of information behind it, but we got, in the agency, we got models coming out of our ears, and so I need to understand better what the purposes of the model will be, what the use of the model will be at the end of it, to make sure that we're justified in spending $10 million or more. My guess is that's an $8 million figure from 2008 that we're probably at 10 or 12 now if we looked at the full scoping. So I think it is time for mid-course assessment to get into the details a little bit more, Mr. Shearer, and decide how to continue.
Kate, do you have any idea what the end game is?
What the final result is that?
What sure. Do we do with it once it's complete?
What do we do? Sure, absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the board, Commissioner Landwehr, I think the idea, and keeping in mind that I have been a part of this project since being brought on board, and there was a significant amount of history prior to that, so I cannot speak to that, and I cannot speak to the changing nature of the idea of this decision support tool. My understanding of what the idea of it is today is that it would be an interactive tool, so something that has a web presence, I would guess, that that you as a landowner would plug in your locational information, the types of BMPs that you might employ, or what your options would be. And the question has been, at this point, should the DSS be geared really toward the audience that is that everyday landowner, or should it be more the agency level or the SWCD level to say, given this area, given this subwatershed area, the best, most beneficial BMPs to include would be habitat restoration, for example, as compared to buffer strips, just as an example. And so therefore, if certain types of programs would be more effective in a grant program, how to match those up. So the idea is that we would have this tool that would inform those decision-making skills so that local grants, state grants for BMPs, habitat restoration, ecological restoration would be able to be used more effectively to get that better bang for your buck. Does that help? Or
Mr. Chair, Kate, so that helps, I think. So I think what you're saying is if we had that decision support tool, which is the final product out of all of this, I could look at a particular piece of land and I could say, okay, I have $100,000 I want to reduce erosion off of here. I could apply it with practice A, I could apply it with practice B, I could apply it with practice C, Monte Carlo those treatments on a piece of property and understand what the change would be in sediment in erosion sedimentation.
Commissioner and Commissioner Landwehr, yes, that's my understanding. And not only that, that's why the Tier 3 modeling has been such a pivotal point of this study, because that's really on-the-ground data. So soils data, hydrology data from location by location, which can vary across the basin, whereas that Tier 1 is much more general. That was kind of the interest in this, the value of this study is having that really detailed on-the-ground information could then tell you not only which are your best three, but given that you, at the end of the year, maybe you have so many tons of sediment loss off of your farm field that putting in a restored wetland might reduce it by this many tons, whereas a buffer strip would reduce it by so many tons. Now, I'm speculating and getting off into the weeds, but that's kind of the idea. That's the direction that they've been going.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
And that's a great example, Kate. I mean that is greatly a value add. I think to your point, Commissioner Landwehr, 5 years ago those tools were not readily available. There are new tools being developed, as you said, in all kinds of agencies that could do comparable things. So I think the timing is right to ask the question, is the money better spent? Where is the money better spent in terms of developing those tools? We've got an agricultural water quality certification program coming online as well. And so I think it's really the right time for us to say what's the right scale, what's the right set of tools, and what are the right programmatic areas of priority for the administration represented by EQB to pursue. I don't know, I'm in the same camp with you. I am not sure that this is the best utilization of our resources. It may be, but I'd really like to have that discussion.
Have you got a plan in mind?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would recommend that we form a small group of a subset of EQB to get together with the Corps as co-sponsors and really ask the questions more thoroughly with our staff expertise in tow, so we can have a good thorough discussion of the value of pursuing the rescoping efforts that the Corps is currently discussing. And then decide if the end date is still appropriate, if there are other tools or or products, services that we should consider for this project that might add greater value to the overall management of the watershed.
Okay. Let me, for the record, Kate Knuth has joined us. Good to see you. Thank you for being here. Would you be willing to head that small group up?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
Never recommend a small group.
That's
Mr.
right.
Willing to head it up.
That's and how small would you like it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there are some three or four agencies. Certainly, the Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Water and Soil Resources, our agency, would be meaningful contributors. I think your Department of Agriculture would be as well. So I think.
How about this? That maybe I point you to head a delegation up to sit down with the Corps and be accompanied by Tom Landwehr and Brian, and then to keep all of you honest, would like.
I can do it.
Yeah, that
citizen
exactly
member would be great.
So,
thank you, Kristen.
I happen to live in this watershed. Yeah.
Great.
So.
Thank you.
So if Kristen would be there to keep them all on target and
got it.
Is there a general agreement, or does everyone want to serve on that prestigious group? And Kate, you'll no doubt be available to assist them.
Of course.
So excellent.
Thank you.
Thank
good plan.
You
both for agreeing to do that. All right. Any public testimony on that particular agenda item? Not. Let's move then to the next item on the agenda, which is Fillmore, Houston, and Winona Silica Sand Facility EIS update. And Jeff Schmeiser will provide us an update. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. We'll get this pulled up here and do the slideshow from the beginning. Just a little quick review. You might recall that the EQB did receive requests from Fillmore, Houston, and Winona counties to assign a single state agency as the responsible governmental unit, the RGU, for an environmental impact statement, an EIS, here we go with the government acronyms, involving multiple sand facilities in several different counties. And on March 20th, our last meeting, the EQB assigned itself as the RGU for a phased action EIS. Some of the EQB member agencies and thus members of the board are involved in, frequently in many cases, preparing or reviewing environmental review documents. That's not true of everybody. Thought it might be a good idea to just have a relatively quick primer on environmental impact statements, how they work, what are the steps behind them. The summary that I'm going to be giving here is taken right from a booklet that is available online. It's a guidance document. It's called Guide to the Rules, Guide to the Environmental Review Rules. Anybody can download it, and I just thought it'd be a good idea to just run through these things, run through this list so everybody has an idea of what's going on. So first of all, we'll just go through the steps in the timeline. The step zero, which is sort of before there's actually a formal step, is communication between the proposer and the RGU. I'll get into where we're at in the process right now, and we're actually at step zero minus one right now. We haven't really formally begun communicating with the proposer. That will come soon, and I'll get into where we're at, that's next part of the
Jeff, who initiates that? Is it?
That will be us.
Initiate the.
Right. Ms. Chair, members of the board, it's really, you know, sort of whoever calls the other one first. I had one phone call with a representative of the project proposer, and frankly, they were saying, we were afraid that you were mad at us because we hadn't called you yet. And I said, no, we were afraid that, you know, you were mad at us because we hadn't called you yet. No, we were mad. No, we were mad. So anyways, it's everybody knows that, you know, there's a lot of
nobody's mad
do.
And it's totally nobody's ridiculous.
Mad. Yeah. Everybody's afraid, but nobody's mad.
So, I always thought that this process was really scientific, but it appears
not
that,
yet.
You know, it's sort of
the beginning. At the beginning, yeah. It's not. But yeah. I'll get into where we're at on it anyways. So once we start the communication, we start talking about what's it going to be, start talking about the scope and things, the proposer will have to submit data for scoping EAW. In the case of this EIS, which is a mandatory environmental impact statement, there is no EAW that... A lot of projects, there's an EAW, then they go through the EAW and then decide, should we do an EIS or not? When it's a mandatory EIS, you jump, you go, you cut right to the chase and you prepare what in this case would be a scoping EAW. It's an EAW, but it's intended to scope out what are we going to study, what do we know, things like that. It's a little different from the regular EAW. So they would submit data for the scoping EAW. They would also submit the payment for the EAW, which will have been negotiated as part of step zero and step negative 0.25. I mean, it's, you know, at that point it's a little informal, but we will be revving that up soon. At any rate, the scope of the EIS will be determined as part of the scoping process. That's what the rules require. And the reason I want to point that out is that there is no predetermined, this is what we're going to study. There are a number of sites that are being considered. It may be that those sites are all included. It may be some of them aren't. There may be other facilities that would be included in the scope, depending on if they're considered to be connected, phased, related. That's all part of the negotiation and discussion with the proposer. Neither one of us already has selected what's going to be involved in that. So that's part of the process. So once they submit data for the scoping EAW, the RGU, the Environmental Quality Board in this case, will look at it, decide if it's complete. If it's complete, we say, yeah, okay, we're going with this. We're going to prepare the document. If it's not complete, we'll, you know, formally return it to them. Really, it's about, hey, you know, we need this in addition to, and then you sort of an iterative process. It's not really a one-shot deal where they just send something and you go, yeah, okay, here we go. I think that in a lot of communities out there on a regular EAW process, the communities that don't deal with environmental reviews very often, they figure that the project proposer just prepares the document, they sign it and send it out. That's one way of doing it. I think that maybe they're not aware of the fact that the RGU is responsible for what's in that document. So we're going to be a little more careful than that. I can guarantee everybody that we want to make sure that what's in this document is something that we agree with and, you know, is supportable. We're not going to be rubber stamping anything. Well, says me, right? No, says you, ultimately. The RGU... reviews the EAW submittal, if it's complete, notifies incomplete, return for corrections, and then we will be preparing the scoping EAW and the scoping decision document. Now, bear in mind that we would be putting together information as part of the scoping EAW while we're talking with the project proposer. We're not going to wait for them to give us information. There are some things we know already. So it's sort of this multi-parallel process of putting together the document. Because the information is often some comes from the project proposer, some the agencies already know, some we'll get from other sources. So it's really sort of a multi-source thing going on here. The draft scoping AW and the draft scoping decision document, once they're finished, they will be distributed for comment. There'll be a notice in the local newspaper and a notice in the EQB monitor, and that's when the 30-day comment period begins. There will be public scoping scoping comment meetings.
Where, Jeff, where would they be? Would they be in the counties?
In the counties where the project's going to occur. There may be one meeting. There may be multiple meetings. It really sort of depends on how we work that out as part of the scoping and the costs. Once the scoping comment period ends, then the RGU would be approving the final scope. We would then finish the scoping decision document and say, this is what we're going to study. Bang. Now, I went through these very quickly, but there's something that I really do want to point out, and that is the public comment period for scoping really is extremely important. Public access to the whole environmental review process is a very important objective of the whole program as it was designed originally. So even though, you know, I just sort of banged through the steps here, it really is important to get out there and hear what other people say, whether they agree with the scope, whether they want more, whether they want less, things like that. So it's not just a rubber stamp process. So the RGU and the proposer arranged to prepare the draft EIS. We'd be, you know, send a cost agreement, proposed cost agreement. That's when the discussion on the cost of the EIS goes on. The proposer pays half the estimated cost. We arrange to hire consultants to assist with the preparation if we need consultants, that sort of thing. The cost agreement is a contract. It says they're going to pay us X amount of money to do this. If anything's left over, it would be returned to them. I mean, it's not a small thing to prepare this contract. I mean, it's a large amount of money, and we really need to take it seriously. So the step zero and step 0.05 that I was talking about, the costs will, you know, be start being discussed probably even back at that point. So then we say, okay, we are going to prepare an EIS officially. Publication goes out, is published in the EQB Monitor, and that's really when the 1-2-3 go starts on preparing the document. So the RGU, our consultants, the proposer, their consultants, we start doing the research, connecting the studies, and preparing the draft EIS document. The preparation notice starts the clock, the big clock of the whole thing. From the date when it's published, the EIS has to be done in 280 days. It's not an awful lot of time when you think about the scope of a large project. That's why you really want to get as much things set up so that when you get to the point where you're publishing the notice, you can really just take off and run it. That's, you know, you want to get as much work done on the preliminaries before that. Preparing the EIS, this step 12, really
Jeff, what happens if you miss that deadline in 280 days and you are at a point where you're just not going to make it? What is there a possibility to amend the contract? Or?
Yes, it can be extended by agreement.
I see.
There's also a clause where the governor can step in and say this is going to be extended. I doubt if that would happen, but there is a possibility to do that. The thing is that, well, we'll get there. That's a good point, and we'll get there in a little bit. Once the EIS is prepared, we would distribute the draft. The notice that it's available goes out in the EQB Monitor. There are public information meeting or meetings held, again, in the county or counties where the project's going to occur. Once we get through there, there's a written comment period, and that ends. And I'm going to repeat myself, public access and input, and this is really important. We will really make an effort to ensure that we get as much public discussion and input on this as possible. Once we go through that on the draft, we will, you know, respond to the comments, obtain additional information, whatever is determined appropriate after the draft EIS process and review goes through, and then we'll be preparing the final EIS document. The RGU would then, that's us, would distribute the final EIS. There'd again be a notice that the final EIS is available, and then there'll be a comment period on the adequacy of the final EIS. Okay, so if the RGU determines at the end of that it's adequate, it's done. This is supposed to be done within 280 days. If it's not, it could be extended by agreement. It could be extended by the governor. Here's the thing is, like I say, if the EIS, the final EIS, is judged adequate, then the process is ended. If it's not adequate, we have another 60 days to revise it, go through the last few steps again. I mean, we just need to keep going through this until the RGDU decides that, you know, we've done our job and we know what we're going to find out. So getting back to your question, Mr. Chair, if we get to the 280 days and we're not comfortable, then, you know, the EIS is not adequate. Another 60 days, another 60 days. So there is opportunity to make sure that this gets done properly, and we want to make sure that the EIS, we were talking about the term adequate earlier today, you know, it's a bad term, you know, it's like, it's good, it's going to be a really good product, it's not
Minnesota,
really
adequate. It's good enough.
Yeah, it's good enough, yeah, good there enough. We go.
We know what that means. Adequate.
But the importance of the preliminary work is pointed out here, particularly the scoping. A number of people from different agencies have let me know very, very clearly, you really need to put the attention into the scoping, because if not, you're going to get to the end and find out, oops, we didn't think about that. And then it just takes more time anyway. So make sure that the scoping is done properly. It's a really, really important part of the whole project. Okay, what are we doing now?
Mr. Chair.
Bob.
Jeff, could you just point out to the board what steps are there? What are the decision points that they'll be involved with, the board will be involved
with? Oh, okay. It would be do we release the scoping EAW and draft scoping decision document? Are we comfortable with the after the comment period on that? We would revise it and end up with our final scoping EAW and scoping decision document. They would make a decision on is the draft EIS ready for distribution for public comment. We would make a decision on what needs, you know, it, once that process goes through, is the final acceptable to release? Is the final, should it go out? And then the decision on the adequacy. We will have, I'm anticipating, a number of discussions on particular points, updating. There may be things that the board says, you know, I want a little more attention on that, or I think we're okay on that, as we are preparing things. Each one of these is a little bit of a different animal, and I think this multi-project, multi-county one is unique in many ways. It's not the first one that's been done on a number of projects that stretch over a larger geographic area as opposed to one particular site. But the nature of the sand industry, as we've talked about before, is unusual in that there are so many different elements to it, you know, the mining, the processing, and the transportation between them, and the transportation going out to wherever the sand ultimately is going to be used in the oil or gas fields, is that this is going to be a fascinating exercise. Let's just put it that way. I think we're all going to learn a lot about it.
Mr. Chair.
Brian.
Thank you. Jeff, I believe in a normal EAW EIS process where the EQB is not the RGU. I believe if there's a challenge to the EAW or the EIS, that can be appealed, whether or not it's been complete or accurate or whatever. And I believe that is appealed to the EQB, is it not?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, yes and no, depending on the situation. The EQB can step in on, sort of walking backwards from the end of a process, the EQB can step in on the adequacy of an EIS. That's something that under the rules we have authority to step in on if we want to. But when it comes to should there be an EIS after an EAW, no, we don't have the authority to step in, other than the same authority that any individual or group in the state of Minnesota or anywhere has, which is you go to court, you sue. So we have, the EQB has the authority to reassign the responsible governmental unit. We have the authority to decide if an EIS is adequate. We have the authority to declare that a project needs an environmental review, an EAW. But those are the three things that we actually have the authority to step in and do.
Bob, Mr. Chair, one? Jeff, there's one more, which is a cost dispute.
Have a follow-up, Brian?
Yeah, I guess a follow-up would be the occasion that you mentioned is we have the authority to declare an EIS complete.
Inadequate. We have the authority to declare somebody else's, complete or inadequate. Complete or not complete, if you will. Yes.
Yeah, terminology. Sorry. We can we have the authority to determine that an EIS is complete. And on those occasions when somebody disagrees with us, they can appeal it to us. If this were to be appealed, if when we make a decision on whether it's adequate or inadequate, any challenges would go immediately to court. They would not go through the EQB because we are the body making the decision.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, that's a fascinating legal question. I don't know the answer to that. The rules say an appeal goes to the EQB. Well, the rules say the EQB can step in, but an appeal, as I understand it, goes right to the court. They don't appeal to us. The EQB can unilaterally step in and say, your EIW, county so-and-so, is inadequate. You need to do more work. I suppose somebody could ask us to do that, but it's not so much an appeal formally. It's, somebody could ask us to look at it, and then the EQB would look at it and perhaps decide that EAW is not adequate. But it's not a matter of somebody appealing to us. I can check that. But ultimately, if our EIS, if somebody wants to contest it, they'd have to sue.
Bob, do you want to, you opened up a little bit of a discussion on cost, and you might want to finish that up.
Yes, I was just looking up the adequacy provision as well. But, Mr. Chair, yes, on that point, I guess I didn't necessarily intend to start a discussion, but
that's what happens.
That's what happens. That's right. Yes, the EQB, and I was looking for that provision too. The EQB does have the authority where there is a dispute between the project proposer and the RGU on the cost of the EIS. The EQB has the authority to that can be brought to the EQB to determine, and that's the only time in my career that's happened. That was on the Hancock Pro-Pork EIS, where there was a cost dispute between the proposer and the PCA, and that was brought to the EQB to resolve that cost dispute. And it was a very lengthy process.
But in this case, they would complain to the EQB, and then the EQB could
in this case, we are the RGU, and so that's really probably a real good question as far as how that works with us being the RGU.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, maybe that just underlines that we just need to do this well so there won't be any disputes.
Correct. Right. Excellent.
That was the intent of my conversation.
Yeah. Kind of figured that out.
Any other?
And that's an important part of, like I say, we need to do our homework up front. The scoping and all that sort of stuff that all needs to be done.
Mr. Chair and the board and Mr. Knapp said, I just wanted to go over the determination of adequacy part. So the RGU determines the adequacy of a final EIS. But there is a provision where at the request of the RGU, the proposer of the project, or other interested persons, the EQB will determine the adequacy. So that's where it goes to the EQB. And there are standards for when the EQB intervenes. So in this case, obviously, we are again in that position where we are the RGU. But that's how it normally works.
Didn't we have a draft of 4410 make that available to everyone on the board for their recreational reading?
Yeah, I think we'll have it.
And some of them have well-worn copies, and so it might be a good time to refresh. Right. Charlie understands 4410 totally.
Yeah, I'll explain
it
to
you. Memorized?
Maybe.
Yeah, all right.
Make sure you get the nightstand size, not the full size.
Yeah.
But I clearly remember Commissioner Landwehr coming with this well-worn copy. Yes, right. Right, and we all were jealous that you actually had it, and envious. But it might be a good idea for all of us to, shine that up a little bit and shine up our background knowledge.
And Mr. Chair, members of the board, not to take the shine off the dog-eared copies, but since we just went through a rule revision, there is a 2013 version of them all. So.
Oh, exciting. Exciting. All right.
The old ones are vintage copies.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and that
increased in value.
That's right. That's right.
You and have one too, don't you?
Oh, yeah, that's
can't go with you.
I think I saw one on Antiques Roadshow a couple weeks ago.
Are they bound like the one you have in your hand, and are they available for public distribution?
Sure they're not, Mr. Chair.
But do you have anyone, or would you know anyone that would be able to provide us with a dozen or more copies?
I think we've got some lying around.
Done. All right, we'll have them made available, and maybe, huh? Good. I look forward to it.
We'll get to get a color copy.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, members of the board, where are we at now? We are with the invaluable assistance of Myrna Halbach at the MPCA, preparing a project manager description of, the person who's going to be running this project on behalf of the RGU, which is us. We are assembling preliminary needs, what kind of work is going to need to be done? Do we need a consultant to do this? It's a big question, and it's really a multi-agency discussion. If we get somebody to step in and work on this, do they have to backfill to do the work that that person was doing in whatever state agency that person is working with? So that's a big discussion. And we are assembling information, a lot of background information, for example, what EAWs have been prepared, what's in there, to inform our discussions with the project proposers, which will then lead to step zero, which is when we formally start sitting down with them and putting together what's the scope going to be, the cost agreements, all that sort of thing. Tentative schedule. And now this was prepared almost a month ago. So, it was looking forward at the time, but it's so it's very rough. It's very tentative. Obviously, we were assigned as the IGU in March. The original view would that be trying to hire the project manager by the end of this month. I think we're probably pushing that, but we'll see. Organized state and local government teams, as I said, trying to figure out, who's going to be needed, how that's going to work. This month or next month, we'll be meeting with the project proposer and start working on the cost agreement. Draft scoping, EAW, we're hoping, could be done May and June, public notice in July and August, the meetings, all that sort of thing. Approval of the scope, that would be the final scoping decision, September. And then at that point, that's when, you publish a notice, and about 280 days after that in June of next year is when we are hoping to aim for when this EIS would be completed. And again, that's pretty tentative. I haven't talked about polishing this up since a couple of weeks ago when this tentative schedule was first put together.
Bob?
Mr. Chair, and Jeff, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to point out this is also a very ambitious schedule from the draft scoping EAW to the end of scoping, because as Jeff mentioned, the preparation of the scoping EAW, the submittal of the drafts back and forth can be an iterative process, and one of the things we want to make sure is we get the scope right. As Jeff mentioned, the scope, having a good scope is a foundation for a good EIS and a good and efficient EIS process. And so we really want to get the scope right to be able
So it may take longer time, I guess, is all I'm saying here. So thanks.
All right. Jeff, any final comments?
Oh, Mr. Chair, unless any members of the board or anybody else has any questions about it, I didn't have anything more.
Oh, there's somebody in the audience.
Yes, please.
I know, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Jeff, do we know?
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Brett Skilbred. I work with Jordan Sands, and we're currently a proposer in the silica sand industry.
Welcome.
Working through the EAW process. My question is, do we know who the proposer is at this point? Because we have heard that this project was being put on hold.
Jeff?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, the project proposer as it stands is Minnesota Sands. Now, as I was going through, the scope of this EIS may theoretically expand beyond Minnesota Sands facilities. So the project proposer would be perhaps more than one. That is a possibility, and that would have to be determined as part of the scoping process. What facilities that were previously considered that in the phased actions, will all of those be included in the EIS? We don't know. Will more facilities be added to the scope? We don't know. That's going to have to be determined as part of the scoping process. So we're starting out with Minnesota Sands facilities, and as the scoping decision and process proceeds, it may stay there or it may be more.
Great, thank you.
Follow up? No? All right, thank you. Other questions? Brian?
Jeff, I'm looking at your tentative schedule, and if I'm interpreting correctly, one of the previous slide, hire a project manager. If I interpret that correctly, as that means an engineering firm and outside of the agency, outside of the EQB?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, no, that we may be hiring a consultant to do some things. Theoretically, it could be an outside agency. I think at this point, the thought is more somebody, an individual to just act as our point person on it. But that is still up in the air. It's a good question. It could be an engineer, could be somebody inside.
What I was going to suggest is that as I look at the schedule, this EIS goes forward with or without legislative approval of additional FTEs for the EQB.
Yes.
If we have approved additional additional staffing, then that project manager may or may not be within.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, the project manager, regardless of whether it's an individual, a new hire, somebody from one of the agencies, or a contracted firm, the cost of that would be covered by the project proposer as part of the cost agreement. So that's not something that we would have to have money allocated for from the legislature. Now, that being said, it is possible that some work needs to be done. Well, we know that some work needs to be done before all the money is collected. So, but it would be tracked and, you know, basically sort of back charged, if you will. So it's possible that an agency will carry it for a short period of time, but it will get paid for. So any work on the EIS.
The term hire could be misinterpreted. I mean, it could be an internal.
Or external.
So we identify somebody to serve.
All those possibilities are possible.
John, or if you had a follow-up, Brian, no?
No, I'm fine.
And Mr. Chair, just Commissioner Knapp said raised a good point. I think the question for the board to consider and advise Bob, I would say, in terms of, may not be ready to do it today, but I would urge people to consider what you think would have the greatest value for EQB. EQB doesn't do EISs hardly ever. So we don't have a lot of practical experience with the point you raise, Brian, which is, should we hire someone? Should we borrow someone from from an existing state agency? Should we bring on a consultant? And I think it would be worthwhile for board members to think about that and advise the executive director on what you think would lend value to the process. And there are several factors in thinking that through. The public will be contributing a lot of information as this process goes forward. There were clearly three counties that asked us to do this project, and it might be just helpful for us to, again, not today, but in the future, have that kind of advice go to the executive director so that we can weigh in on the subject. We don't do this very often, if ever at all, and so it's important that we develop a sense of how we're going to make these decisions and advise. Obviously, the executive director administers the work of the board, but it's important for us to get engaged in helping think that through.
Up? Any response?
No.
Okay. Thank you, John. All right. If there are no further comments or questions, thank you very much, Jeff. This has been incredibly informative to me, having not gone through an EIS on a personal level. So thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. I'm trying to
get lucky stars.
Yeah, right. Yes, I'm now tainted, right? Yeah. All right. The next item, unless there's other public comment on the issue that we've just completed, I'll move then to the next item on the agenda, and we'll go to the Governor's Institute on Community Design Workshop update, and welcome Ellen Anderson.
Thanks.
And Anna Sherman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just a brief update on the upcoming workshop and follow-up from the Congress. So I'm going to start backwards, looking backwards towards follow-up from the Congress. We have received, our event planner has received evaluations from many of the attendees of the Congress. We're still going through those, so we don't have any kind of formal report to give you, but we've heard back from a lot of people who attended, and we've gotten a lot of really helpful positive comments, and lots of enthusiasm about having the Congress, period, and people are very, very happy that we did it. And also, people, many of the attendees have asked to have this be an ongoing event. So just want you to know that. We'll give you some more feedback about what the evaluations show later on. I wanted to revisit the issue of videotaping the Congress. We had a brief discussion about that at the last EQB meeting a month ago, and I think everyone reiterated that it's a priority to have this recorded, and, well, we've already had it recorded, but to have it available in a recorded format for posterity, for people to use, hopefully, and actually make some value out of that. All of that talent that we had in the room and all the information and input and expertise. I think it seems that our limited staff in the different agencies that do videotaping may be too overworked to really manage this project, because it will take a significant number of hours. So we wanted to suggest today that maybe we should go the route of doing an RFP. I'll throw that out there as a recommendation from staff and let you all respond to that. But just to say that the EQB said this was a high priority and did authorize some additional funding to do it. I don't have an exact estimate of what that might cost. And so what I would suggest is, if you want to go ahead with an RFP, is that we'd have to work with some of the videographer staff to help us draft that, because they're the experts about technically what's needed, and they're also the experts about what's the best way to do this at the very lowest cost possible. So sort of what would be the no-frills model and what that would cost us. It would be hard for me to estimate that right now.
Mr. Chair.
John.
Our communications staff will take the lead on that, and if there are other agencies, communicators that want to participate, we'll convene the team. So
convene a team
to work on an RFP and yeah, really nail down what the actual alternatives would look like.
Yeah, I think we committed to do that. We need to follow through on that, and hopefully we'll get requests back that are reasonable. And I was thinking, let's see, if it were 18,000, that would be 9 apiece, right? If we had two apiece. I'm sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Presumably, there's something that we had already allocated.
Yeah. Hopefully we can get that accomplished, but we committed to do it, and I think we really need to follow through from a public perspective.
Mr. Chairman, just as a point of information, Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, little school, has a phenomenal videography department with lots of folks that they attract a lot of different students and staff, very well known for their abilities with editing, and might be in that price range as providing also an experience mm-hmm. for students. So just as a point of information for you.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. We'll make sure that we ask the RFP to allow and accommodate for that sort of participation.
Thanks.
Mr. Landwehr.
Mr. Chair, item number 3B on my position description requires me to be a curmudgeon. I want to assert that...
So what else is new?
We do a lot of things that we put on the web for public information that are never, ever visited. And I would just caution us as we think about this, what the viewership might be. Because if we spend $20,000 and we get 200 viewers, we might as well just give each of them a $100 bill and say, find out about it. So I just want to cautious. One of the things I'm aware of when we do this video, it has to be available in alternative formats, which means that it has to be transcribed. There has to be, you know, all kinds of things done to this to make it available to anybody who wants it. And so it is not an inexpensive undertaking that we're proposing.
I agree. But before we get to that point, I think we have to submit for proposals, and then yet the decision to accept those will still be up to the board, and so you can put on your Krabby Pants at that time.
3B, curmudgeon.
Yeah, yes, right.
4B is Krabby Pants.
Oh, I see. Okay. Right. So you will. The board will still have the final say as to whether or not we go ahead. So if they come in incredibly high, well, we'll look to you for leadership.
All right.
Excellent.
Sounds good. That sounds like a plan. And finally, in terms of getting ready for the workshop, as you all know, is scheduled for May 2nd, and there will be an all-day workshop, and it'll be at the Veterans Building, so it'll be right on the campus, I want to say, on the Capitol Mall, so it's easily accessible for most of you. And we have a follow-up scheduled now for June 11th, and that'll be a half-day follow-up. And at that time, we will hopefully know what the legislature has decided, and we'll have a better sense of what the EQB's resources are that are available to it, because obviously, as staff keeps reminding us, we need to be cognizant of all the existing commitments that the EQB has as we move forward. But we did put together the Commissioner Fredrickson asked four members of the board to serve as an ad hoc subcommittee to work on the planning. And so we've asked board members Napstad and Knuth, as well as Commissioner Stein and Zelli, to participate in this subcommittee. And they are hard at work on helping to nail down in detail how the workshop will proceed, and talk to the various experts that GICD, that the Governor's Institute on Community Design, are bringing here to share their expertise with us on May 2nd. And those experts will include at least one former governor and some former state and federal cabinet members from various states who will share some of the information they have to help us understand ideas for best practices. And I think the objective of the workshop, we've pretty clearly discussed this many times, but I'll just reiterate what we're talking about, which is to build upon all of the input that we've received through the whole executive order process and come up with actionable priority goals and implementation plans and measurable outcomes to help achieve our vision on environmental issues. So I would be happy to take any questions. That's really all I have for an update right now. We would like to get confirmations of everyone who can attend May 2nd, and I hope it's all of you. and we've been in touch with your offices or your personal numbers, so please make sure you let us know if you haven't already, if you can attend.
Thanks, Ellen. Questions for Ellen? John, did you, or are you just...
No, I just, Mr. Chair, thought, you know, it would be helpful to acknowledge that a number of us who were on the planning team had a conversation yesterday about trying to narrow and clearly appreciate the scope. with limited amount of time. One day is very limited, but important day to bring forward actionable items. We did have a good discussion yesterday. I felt like we know that we're starting with a list that builds off the report card and the Congress. And while that's not the comprehensive set of environmental information that the state uses, is it sets a plan in action, it is sort of our starting point. And so we're going to try to convey that in further conversations with the folks from the Institute as well as ourselves and really prepare our. So as you look at the information from the Congress, from the report card, as well as the governor's executive order, might be really for your thoughts and reflection time. Dig into that a little bit so that you're grounded on what you think about all of those documents and exercises and important meetings that were held. So that's just sort of my take on how we left the conversation yesterday, and we'll be doing more planning in the coming days, so we'll keep you posted.
Thanks, John, and thank all of you for taking the time to participate on the call. I know that Commissioner Napstead actually pulled into the Menard store and took the call, but I'm thinking it was a thinly veiled disguise to go to Menards.
Mr. Chair, I figured that if the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation was on the line, I'd better not be on a conference call at 70 miles an hour.
Smart move. We're tracking you.
I thought maybe a Dairy Queen might have been better. Commissioner Napstead.
I think during the planning session call yesterday, I think we were all coming from a little bit different directions, and we're all groping a little bit for what's going to come out of this planning session. And during the phone call, Commissioner Stein volunteered the strategic plan for the Pollution Control Agency, which you emailed out to all the attendees. And I looked at that, and that really helped me try to understand what might be the product coming out of this strategic planning session. So I would just encourage those who are involved in tomorrow's subcommittee planning call to look at that document, the strategic plan that is on the, I think you sent it all out to the members.
I can forward it to everyone. So
it really lends some clarity and discipline as to what we might get out of this and the document we could move forward on.
Great. Thanks.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate those comments. And also just wanted to add that we're working on a memo. Kate France is leading that along with a lot of other staff input that we'll be sending to all of you, which kind of summarizes all the background information and all the supporting documents that we want you to go through and review that represent the totality of all this information to help prepare for the workshop. So be prepared for that, and hopefully you'll have a little bit of time somewhere in your busy schedules to read through some of those background information pieces along with what Commissioner Stein has added to it.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
Anna, did she miss anything? No? Okay. So you're together on that? Good. Thank you very much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Why don't we do this? Take a few-minute break and then reassemble and, you know, in the next 5 minutes or so or 10 minutes, and then welcome Mr. Ken Patel to the table. So let's, if we could reassemble, then I will move on to the final item on the agenda, and that is to welcome Ken Patel, Director of the Ecology Democracy Network. And Ken, good to see you.
Thank you.
And welcome to the EQB board.
Thank you, Chairman Fredrickson. And thank you, board members, for giving me the opportunity to talk to you about the Genuine Progress Indicator. Some of you have received notification about this via email or letter that I've sent out in the past. And it is, there's a few handouts in the agenda today that are in the back of the agenda that I identify as one of the headers will have highlighted smart signals, which is a report that came out in 2000 out of the Environmental Quality Board and the Department of Planning here in the state of Minnesota. And I just wanted to say that I feel in this discussion, the Environmental Quality Board is uniquely positioned to move forward with a new measurement of the state's economic health or well-being. And that is really one of the key discussions is shifting away from just economic activity, which is what we use as part of deriving the gross domestic product or the state gross product or gross state product, however you want to put it at this point. And I'll just give you a little bit of a history of where I'm coming from in this discussion and then talk a little bit about what my objective is, because one of the goals and what I will seek from the board here today is to solicit one or two delegates from the Environmental Quality Board to go to a summit in Baltimore, Maryland, June 13th, where there will be a gathering of genuine progress indicator practitioners from what I gather now about 15 to 20 states. And basically where this came from, this discussion for me and why I'm here today, Governor Carlson in the mid-90s convened a sustainability roundtable. And that sustainability roundtable was made up of citizens, business representation, government agencies, and a couple of other interested individuals that were involved. And the sustainability roundtable came out eventually with a report, which was oversaw by the Department of Planning. Initially, it was financed by the Legislative Commission on Natural Resources. Then it was handed off to the Environmental Quality Board, and then the Department of Planning helped oversee the effort. Smart Signals was a report that came out of this effort, the Sustainability Roundtable. Also, Commissioner Ron Sando with the Department of Natural Resources at the time also oversaw this effort. What we have is a shift away from the gross domestic product as a measurement of our state's economic health to what was established at that time, which was the Minnesota Progress Indicator, based upon the genuine progress indicator. And what we're doing is moving away from just showing economic activity, which is what the gross domestic product or the gross state product is, and does not show value. It just shows the volume of activity in our economy at the state level or at the national level. And what a genuine progress indicator does is it shifts away from that to showing values that would not necessarily be able to be monetized. And it shows values that are considered externalities right now. It starts to internalize external costs associated with pollution, air quality, human health issues, so on and so forth. It also shows values associated with volunteerism, stability of families, equity in the economy. It starts to reevaluate these measurements. And part of the measurements that were used to establish the Minnesota progress indicator at that time out of the Smart Signals report was based upon what was known as Minnesota Milestones. Some of you may be familiar, Minnesota Milestones, which is, I think, now about 60 or 70 indicators. Most recently, it was revamped in 2011 here at the state through Department of Demographics. And they used 42 measurements to establish the Minnesota Progress Indicator as part of the Smart Signals Report. You can go online and get the Smart Signals Report through, I believe, the MPCA, the Next Step Program. I bet you can just Google it and you'll find it. And basically, that's what I'm asking. I'm asking to shift away from what we use as a state measurement, the state gross product or the gross domestic product, and move to the genuine progress indicator or the state progress indicator. what was done by the EQB back in 1999. So in a way, this is a perfect back to the future moment, if you understand what I'm saying. And I'm asking you to help bring this about, to take the Smart Signals report, look at it. We, at that time, it was cutting edge nationally. This genuine progress indicator was cutting edge. We were on the edge of transforming the way we measure our well-being, not just economic activity, but the well-being of our state. And now the state of Maryland has established the genuine progress indicator as their state's measurement of well-being. The state of Vermont has also done this. And Governor Kitzhaber of Oregon, which in a way, Oregon was the inspiration for Minnesota in the early 90s, with Oregon Shines at that time. And they're going to establish the genuine progress indicator very shortly. Utah is on the brink of establishing the genuine progress indicator. Governor Patrick out of Massachusetts will be sending a delegation to this gathering in Baltimore, and many other states in the country are moving on this agenda. Other places in North America have moved in this effort as well. Nova Scotia has established using the genuine progress indicator. Edmonton just not long ago did research to establish it as part of their measurements. And then also globally, we've seen the gathering 2 years ago in Bhutan of 70 nations to sign on to establish the Gross National Happiness Index, another very similar form of measuring our health as a region, state, planet, to start getting more accurate. The key here is accuracy. Are we going to be accurate in our measurements? Everyone knows when we receive our electric bill, we see the price per kilowatt hour, but we don't know what the real cost is for that electricity. When you're budgeting, you need to have accurate measurements to establish what is not just the benefit of this investment in a quarterly balance sheet or a yearly return, but what's the benefit, the whole cost, the life cycle cost of this investment as a state. So we start shifting from short-term to more long-term planning inherent in the model itself. We're seeing convergence also pertaining to something that some people here in this room understand, which is health in all policies. Health in all policies, there's going to be, at the same time, there is a convention taking place in Baltimore that I'm seeking your help to send delegates to. There's going to be a convention here in Minnesota, health in all policies. There's overlap with this effort, and I've got information with me. I don't want to read in front of you, so I'm not going to read. I did bring a lot of highlighted material, but I'm not going to read from it. But everyone here knows the Minnesota Department of Health is a good contact for this. There was one report that I was very intrigued with that they came out with, which was the Divine Mercy Development Health Impact Assessment. You can get this online. Some of you may be known where they did health impact assessments, and also they used measurements in their health categories around air quality, land development, parks, trees, vegetation, pertaining also to climate change, so on and so forth. So there's a convergence. At the same time, that same weekend, there's going to be an international gathering in Finland, in Helsinki, around health in all policies. And that will be through the World Health Organization. So we're seeing a convergence about ending the measurements using the gross domestic product and moving to a more accurate way of measuring our well-being as a state. And that is what I'm asking you to help basically pick up the ball, the Smart Signals report, and move forward. And then also I'm seeking your help to establish one or two delegates to go out to Baltimore in June. I've already got my flight booked and my rooms. I'm going to go because I feel like we've got a real opening here to seize this time and seize the momentum. So That's basically it in a nutshell.
You talked a little bit, Ellen shared with me a discussion or a couple of comments you made earlier regarding Robert Kennedy.
Oh, there's a little two-minute piece on YouTube, RFK on the GDP. And that really, part of my inspiration was that little two-minute piece of a speech he made at Kansas University, 1968. 4 months before he died. And so I was intrigued. If you have a chance to go on YouTube, RFK on the GDP, excellent little 2 minutes of, I think, inspiration and insight. There's also, I highly recommend going to the Maryland Department of Natural Resources website. On there, you'll find one of the more interesting websites. Because what it does, the Department of Natural Resources in Maryland has put on their website not only the indicators they use, and I'll just read through some of their indicators they're using now as a state to measure their well-being. Personal consumption expenditures, this is under economic indicators, services of consumer durables, costs of consumer durables, costs of unemployment, those are some. And then they've got social indicators, value of housework, cost of family changes, and this they include in the cost of family changes divorce, TV time, things like that. So they use measurements such as that, and from there they have cost of crime, cost of lost leisure time, and then under environmental indicators they're using things of cost of water pollution, noise pollution, cost of net farmland changes, cost of ozone depletion. So they're integrating these measurements into a single indicator. The Minnesota Milestones, which is excellent and I think has been an inspiration for people around the country for many years now, really was more of a dashboard approach of indicators. The Genuine Progress Indicator is a very powerful singular indicator. I think that's what makes it so appealing. And I think when Smart Signals was decided in Smart Signals, I'd like to just read one portion of that report that came out of the Environmental Quality Board in 99. Like many indicators, the Genuine Progress Indicator is not perfect. However, the inclusion of issues that have typically remained unmeasured and unrecognized makes the indicator far more informative than any other measure of progress available. This was 99. So I think we can pick up the ball again. This was put to sleep for 10 years. We need to respond to the conditions we're facing. I work on issues pertaining to ecological overshoot. That's my focus. We need to start ending this overshoot quickly. And one of the ways to do this is through new measurements that are more accurate. And that's what I'm asking your help in to do, is to move this agenda. And like I said, you are in a unique position to integrate this into the departments in the state of Minnesota and to start working together to have a far better measurement of well-being for our state. Thank you.
Thank you. I knew, Ed, that you would have your hand up because I know that you advocate health in all aspects of daily life. And so, Commissioner.
Yeah, I want to follow up with health and all policies. We have two of the commissioners at this table who are going to be on a panel in June 12th talking about health and all policies. Sue Haig is actually giving the keynote to the Minnesota Public Health Association annual meeting on health and all policies. So Commissioner Rothman, Commissioner Stein, and Commissioner Casilius are going to be on a panel with me talking about health and all policies. And we've got an initiative at the health department actually to get more engaged with other commissioners on health and all policies because we've had some really good work with transportation and the Department of Natural Resources. So I think it's coming about. And so it's good to hear that there's a lot of other work. We also have staff working with CDC nationally and with some of the community organizations on taking that health and all policies approach. And I may have some staff already going to this conference. I won't be able to go myself, but I would may follow up with to see if some other staff at the health department might be able to attend with you.
That would be great because and Commissioner, I just want to mention that every state will tailor their measurements based upon the uniqueness of each state. So the health and all policies and the GDP, I think we can, there's an overlap there.
With yeah, and we're also linking health and all policies with the way. One of the biggest issues we have is disparities within our state and sure. all sorts of areas. And health and all policies is one of the ways you know, that we're going to actually be able to get at like disparities, to it, health disparities, that's and other ecological and environmental disparities that are present in the state.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Zilli?
Well, I was interested in this idea when I was just reading it and then thinking about it in some other context, but when we have a kind of taking the traditional economic factors and then expanding it, you're saying health, you know, crime, the environment. Am I getting this wrong? But it seems to me like they all are part of an economic kind of framework. I mean, there is a return or even a financial well to benefit to well-being to not only kind of clean water or air, but clearly health, safety. It's just a question that when you call economic, I think those are kind of more traditional measures of the economy. And am I getting this wrong? Is this kind of expanding the idea that let's just really recognize what is truly the value of prosperity? I would just kind of call it. And the reason I come at this a little bit from the transportation side, I think there's actually a price to congestion. There's a price to quality of life. Mm-hmm. There's actually maybe some more better measures coming that there's actually even traditional economic benefits coming from some of those other well-being measures. So I kind of see it as more, maybe more integrated.
Mm-hmm.
And it ultimately at some point might actually be measured in more traditional, economic terms, in terms of return on investments that,
right.
Be made. And it reminds me of this Stephen Rothschild, who's been proposing, I think there's a pilot program to do social bonds, where actually bonds are issued for social service organizations. It's just a pilot thought now, but I mean, it's gaining traction around the country, maybe around the world, where you actually can kind of measure the benefits of achieving social service outcomes,
mm-hmm.
and that there's actually a kind of a marketplace, a way to measure that spills into the rest of the economy. So I kind of like the idea, to the extent that these aren't siloed ways of let's just think that this is great, of actually kind of linking together that it's not only good policy, it's good economic policy to have mm-hmm. those tracked.
Commissioner mm-hmm. Rothman?
No, excellent point.
Commissioner Stein.
You know, your presentation is falling on very receptive ears. We generally, in the administration and in our agencies, think more broadly than necessarily, specific economic impacts. And in all of the decisions we make, look at the value in terms of what we're doing. And as the stewards of not only public policy, but also the budget that we each given in our agencies in terms of what is the best value of the investment, especially given all of the immense challenges that we have ecologically, environmentally, climate, and then with the budget pressures that we're dealing with. We were just talking about the stresses and strains of our daily life, but at the same time, these big decisions are important for all of us. I also wanted to say, and since this is a discussion, that the governor's office and the governor and staff working with the commissioners and ours and us in developing a framework for at least coming into the budget this year, stepped back, looked at the milestones that had been started years ago under Governor Carlson, looked at other states as well, and came up with a dashboard approach in terms of trying to figure this out. We went through a very rigorous. It was rigorous on us for our time in developing sort of taking a look at these different indicators, and you mentioned a few of them, and which ones do you pick, and how do you pick them, and which ones are the most important. So we have set out sort of a working dashboard in terms of community with health, with transportation, the environment, mm-hmm. employment, and to not be guided by just GDP and economic indicators, and then to measure ourselves of where we are in terms of overall as a state, where do we want to go, what's the path forward, but then also to help guide and inform us in decision making, both at the policy level and at the budget level. So I appreciate getting the information about, you know, these old reports and all. They definitely need to be dusted off, but actually modernized in terms of where we are today in 2012, 2013, right. 2014. 5 years from now, what do we want to do and how do we want to achieve it? But I just wanted to say it's a welcome presentation and, you know, very, very important for us to have the discussion. I just finally leave it at this. It's a broader discussion necessarily, as you know, than just the EQB. Mm-hmm. So we would want to probably consult with, the rest of the administration or however we want to do that, Mr. Chair. But I think it's an important issue to be thinking about.
I'm curious. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm curious. Do communities utilize this tool to measure how they're doing, as yeah. opposed to a, you know, it seems to me it would be a tool, Ken, that that communities, larger, smaller communities, could utilize just to determine their health, overall health.
Well, most recently, I'm familiar with Edmonton, but I'm not familiar with. I'm most familiar at the state level. I'm not as familiar with more localized efforts. I mean, maybe work in Halifax that took place in Nova Scotia, yeah. and so on. They've been doing this. GPI Atlantic, and I have a handout in your agenda items from GPI Atlantic. They're very thorough. So I'm not as familiar with the localized efforts, more at the state level. And I did want to mention to Commissioner Rothman, the effort in Maryland that took place was the governor basically convened a team from the University of Maryland, including Herman Daly. If some of you are familiar with Herman Daly, a modern day thinker around ecological economics and the steady state economy, and he was part of the team in Maryland that developed the measurements that they're using. And one thing I do encourage you to do when you go to the Maryland website, there is a calculator on there. So we could plug in Minnesota numbers into their calculator and come up with outcomes as measurements as part of the genuine progress indicator. So it gives us kind of a tool already in place, very advanced.
I remember in the 80s that we're struggling, obviously, and you remember this well also, all across the rural part of Minnesota. And I was serving in the legislature at that time, and we were trying to utilize a tool by which we would measure some economic health. And at that time, the unemployment was the factor. However, we had very low unemployment in rural Minnesota because nobody wanted to hang out there. We were going broke. So clearly the wrong tool by which we would use to measure economic vitality in a community at the time. So
exactly
looking
exactly
at this.
And right now, for example, a standing track of trees doesn't show up on any economic balance sheet, but once you cut it and turn it into chipwood or whatever, now it's got economic value. In a genuine progress indicator measurement, a stand of trees, tree type, soil strength, diversity of species that live within that tree stand, that's now, we can start measuring that and get a more accurate assessment of should we or should we not take down this habitat.
So since this clearly makes a lot of sense, why hasn't it been adopted nationally?
Because there is resistance. So let's take, for example, electrical energy. We've been growing up with electrical energy. Profits are tied to sales. Now, for the interests that are locked into that formula, they don't want to change it. They love it because you can have wasted energy or used energy. Who cares? As long as profits are tied to sales, they're going to make money off of both. So there's certain interests who obviously are making incredible advances within the existing model. And so there's reasons we're locked into the situation. But it doesn't mean that the trends aren't changing. We've hit the wall on certain things like groundwater, topsoil. so on and so forth. Now we're going to be forced out of necessity to shift at this point, whether we want to or not. So part of it is a necessity, and part of it is a choice. And I think we should, you know, seize this moment and really make it a choice.
Well, on that, Commissioner Stein?
Just really wanted to echo what Commissioner Rothman said about how welcome the your presentation is, but also the I don't want to miss the parallel between integrative strategies, right? EQB is one of the few, we're one of the few states in the country that has what we have, right? So we are an integrating entity of sorts. I also think there's some parallel between the, you know, trying to bring conversation around the externalities in our environment, the costs that no one really values and fails to calculate, I would say is another strong parallel that we should think through and really work to understand, because it is, as we look at the data in our agency, we look at greenhouse gas emissions, we are not making progress as a state economically or environmentally on reducing our carbon footprint. We are staying flat while the economy is staying flat. When the economy heats up, I guarantee what's going to happen with that greenhouse gas emission indicator in our state. We're going up, and we're not making investments in the proper areas. And in our agency's opinion, we're simply going to repeat the past and then ask ourselves, why didn't we choose differently or use the time when we could have had invested? So I really think it is a good point for discussion by the board. I don't know if I'll be able to accommodate schedule of going out to Maryland, but it sounds like a very fascinating experience, and I support it. I also wanted to ask, in Maryland, are they using the genuine progress indicator in parallel with other indicators, or is it replaced all other indicators? How are they, from an administration standpoint, how are they playing that out?
Well, I don't think they've, like, for example, they're not saying the gross domestic product should go away.
Right.
They still want the gross domestic product as a form of measuring overall economic activity. But it's not their primary monthly analysis. Oh. They're putting that off over maybe a six-month period of time. The monthly analysis is a genuine progress indicator. That gives them a more accurate measurement when they're budgeting during legislative sessions and so on, and planning a policy in the future. So I think that they're using other measurements, existing measurements, but also I think that their focal point is the genuine progress indicator on a month-to-month basis.
Other questions for Ken?
Mr. Chair.
Eric?
Mr. Patel, I was curious, do you know when the state of Maryland implemented the GPI as a form of measurement?
This was in 2010.
2010.
Yeah, and there was the first national summit last year. Governor O'Malley of Maryland was the keynote and hosted the event. Most likely, they're anticipating he'll be keynoting again this year. And the point person, just to let you know, if you do want to have further counsel on this discussion, Lou Daly, LEWDALY, with DEMOS, DEMOS, is a nonprofit that is facilitating the national, if not international, activity around these new measurements.
Ken, you could forward some contact information and the conference information to Bob, and then we could get that out to each member, and you can make a decision based on that.
That would be great. I'll make sure, Bob, I get that contact person to you and other sources that I've mentioned here. But I did want to emphasize that what Commissioner Fredrickson said, I think it's time.
All right.
Mr.
Eric,
Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Eric, you had a follow-up?
I just had a real quick follow-up comment to the board. Just looking at the agenda for the governor's workshop, Sherry Wilson is a former secretary at the Maryland Department of Environment, and she was there in 2010.
Good point.
Maybe I don't want to hijack an agenda or anything, but maybe as a point to bring up.
Excellent. And I did want to apologize to be interrupting. I did want to mention one of the point people during Governor Carlson's administration was a woman named Linda Kohls, K-O-H-L-S. She's the communication director with MNSCU right now. And she was involved. I've talked with Commissioner Sando, former Commissioner Sando. He's available for discussion to the board, he said. And Governor Carlson also would make himself available.
Excellent. John?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pantel, I wanted to follow up on what Commissioner Fredrickson said about the GPI making a lot of sense. From your perspective, what happened to the MPI in Minnesota? Why did that die?
The Department of Planning was ended. Mm-hmm. That was it. Mm-hmm. It was when the Department of Planning went away, it went away.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Other questions or comments? If not, Ken, thank you very much for being
thank
here.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Informative discussion. Other items that need to be brought before the board? Tom?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just very briefly, a couple of observations I want to make. This work of environmental review is complicated. It's controversial. It's got slow return. It's painful. And yet we have good people that engage in it. And we have good people that engage in it who sometimes their work shines so well, we are obligated as managers to promote them. And I want to make the observation that the person who has been serving me so well in this capacity for the 2.5 years I've been here is Randall Dineen. And I'm delighted and dismayed to advise you that Randall has taken another position within the Department of Natural Resources, and so he won't be functioning as a liaison to the board anymore. And I just want to say publicly how much I've appreciated all the work that he's done for me, for us, in his capacity as a liaison, and thank him for that work.
Well, Randall, I can only echo what I've only had the opportunity to work with you over the last 2 years, but it's been indeed a pleasure, and hope that you make yourself available to this board in, you know, whatever capacity the commissioner will let you.
Or make him.
Yeah, do that. So thank you very much. The mic is yours if you want to respond to all of that gush.
He would not have.
Very smart,
he would
Randall.
Not
that
have endorsed enough, this if he had thought I was
going to. No, I'm sure not. Yeah, thank you, Randall. Well, other comments? Or, if not, thank you very much. A motion to adjourn is
so
in
moved.
Order. If there's a motion, second. Is there a second? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Same sign. The motion carries. The meeting is adjourned. So.